It's 7 a.m. in Tokyo, 4 p.m. in Mexico City, and 6 p.m. here in New York. I'm Julia Chatterley, and wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. And a warm welcome to First Move as always, and here's today's Need to Know. A dance in the heavens, that's just one way to describe the total solar eclipse witnessed by millions across Mexico, the US and Canada on Monday. Israel's Prime Minister says a date has been set for an invasion of Rafah in the south of Gaza. And in the last few minutes, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida landing in the United States for the nation's first state visit in almost a decade. And the last dance. Caitlin Clark missing out on a national title as she plays her final college game. What's next for the basketball phenomenon? We'll discuss all that and more coming up. But first, to the celestial spectacle. The total solar eclipse happened across North America earlier Monday. The path of totality from Mexico through the United States to Canada. And millions of people gathered along the path to witness the magical moment of darkness as the moon blocked the sun's rays. In Vermont, for one couple, it wasn't just a celestial spectacle, though. There was in the air. It was also love.
I love you.
Did you marry me?
Yes! An engagement during a total solar eclipse.
Okay.
This is a supernatural moment as...
Okay, the sun's coming back. I timed that perfectly.
The sun comes back.
That was definitely a yes. Many people in other parts of the country experienced at least a partial eclipse, including some of my team members here in New York. Now, Pete Montine was in the totality path on a special flight watching the solar eclipse from thousands of feet in the air. Pete, first and foremost, what was that like?
It was incredible, Julia. You know, this was a very special and unique thing offered by Delta Airlines. The first flight that they offered, this special In the Path of Totality flight, sold out in 24 hours back in February. I was on the second flight, and I got a lot of swag included with the T-shirt that says Connecting the Cosmos. Of course, we had the glasses, the solar eclipse glasses to protect our eyes. The coolest thing about this flight on this Airbus A320 just arrived back there at Gate 77, here in Detroit, is that the pilots were able to coordinate with the FAA and make two turns in totality while we were in it for about 3 or 4 minutes. So the plane turned to the right and then turned to the left, so those on either side of the plane could get a good view of totality. And what a view we got. It was extremely dark there at 35,000 feet, which was incredibly interesting, something that I was even surprised by. And the experience was actually relatively quiet on board the plane, with people's faces really pressed against the windows, 14 inches tall on this Airbus A320. I want you to listen now to one of the passengers. He says this was really about the experience, and think of what the experience in 2024 is like. Our heads are in our phones. We're mostly disconnected. This was something that really got people together in a really unique and interesting way. You mentioned love being in the air, and it was a bit literal on our flight. We had a man proposed to his soon-to-be wife. They're fiancés now. They're very excited about that. He said it would have been a disaster if she said no, but it turns out that she said yes, and it was extra special, really icing on the cake, that this took place in the air on this special In the Path of Totality flight. This is what some of the passengers said who were on our flight, Delta 1010.
The air gave you an entirely different perspective. When you're on the ground, the biggest impact of an eclipse is when it starts to get dark and all the nocturnal creatures, the animals, the birds, you start to hear all of that. When you're in the airplane, you're not going to experience that, but you're going to get an entirely different visual because you can see so far.
The cool thing about this was we were going fast, about 400 miles an hour up there at 35,000 feet. but totality actually caught up to us. It essentially is going at 1,600 miles per hour. And the one nice thing about being at 35,000 feet is that we were much above the clouds that blanketed a lot of the heartland today. There was a lot of anxiety when we left at Dallas-Fort Worth this morning because of the fact that it was so blanketed in clouds. There was low overcast this morning. Ultimately, they broke up a little bit. But as soon as we were able to get up and through the clouds, we knew that we were going to see this total eclipse like really so few people were able to today, Julia.
Literally just partly at least answered the question I was going to ask you, which was the speed at which you were flying and how totality was moving. So what did you actually see when you were caught up with and then, I guess, overtaken?
You know, it got really dark. It's not unlike being on the ground. It got darker and darker and darker, and then we were in complete darkness. But we were able to sort of see that 360-degree sunset like you experience on the ground. I was seated on the left side of the plane, seat 31A. And so it was sunset on the left side of the plane, looked to the right side of the plane, the DEF seats, sunset over there, too. So it was a really kind of eerie and unique, a bit spiritual, a bit scientific. It was an incredible intersection of a lot of different things. I'm a big airplane geek. I'm a pilot. I've been around airplanes my entire life. I think the only thing that would top this is being able to pilot the airplane myself, although I did talk to one of the passengers who was a flight attendant off duty. He was able to sit in the jump seat, which is the seat that is behind the pilots, typically reserved for off-duty airline crew. That had to be something else, being able to see it out of the front of the airplane, although we at least got to see a little bit of it from our seats on board this flight.
Yeah, I was going to say that was my next question. Did you wish that you were actually flying the plane? And the answer is, of course, yes. Pete, thank you for
always
sharing that. Of course, always.
Anytime.
Yeah. Pete Montine there, thank you. Now, a sudden chill, no wind. If you were in the path of totality, you might have also felt today's eclipse in addition to seeing it. Chad Myers is here with more on how the eclipse affected the weather and what you feel as well as see. Chad.
Temperature went down 9 degrees Fahrenheit, 5 degrees Celsius. As the clouds came away, the whole thing we're talking about, this eclipse itself, just completely covered.
Yeah,
the
we were having some issues there with Chad's with Chad's microphone. That clearly has something to do with the eclipse, so we'll try and reestablish that connection with him and go back to him. But for now, and with me more on the science and the experience, is the one and only Bill Nye, beloved as the science guy. He's also the CEO of the Planetary Society, and he joins me now. Bill, such a pleasure and an honor to have you on the show. I can tell you my team were very excited about this conversation. Tell me what you experienced today and what it meant to you.
So we were in Fredericksburg, Texas, which is in the U.S., not far from Austin, not far from San Antonio, and we were right in the middle of the path. Now, it was cloudy. It was cloudy, just the way everybody's been talking about, the anxiety of the cloudy weather. But the clouds broke enough for us to see it happening. It was spectacular, and a few things happened today, which I'd never seen before. This field in Texas, where there's a lot of cattle grazing even now, a bunch of butterflies. Well, when it got dark, butterflies took, I don't know where they went, but they weren't there anymore. And then a couple other things that were I'd never experienced before were the wind. Like right now, it's a little bit of a breeze. You can see the camera shaking a little bit. But during the eclipse, the breeze just stopped completely. And it was a shared experience. We had close to 1,000 people out here, and it was really cool. And the other thing was this prominence. There's a jet of plasma, of gas and particles off the sun in from our point of view in sort of the lower right. And because the clouds were acting like a filter, cutting some of the brightness, you could see it in a way you couldn't normally. And it turned pink. It was really spectacular.
It's incredible to see the clouds cover behind you, and the fact that for whatever reason, the clouds parted enough for people there to be able to see it. Bill, you know, one of the things that I'd seen you say in so many interviews that you were doing ahead of today was, you know, almost for goodness sake, put your phones down and just experience this few minutes in person, particularly if you're lucky enough to be in the path of totality. Did people take your advice, at least there today, and actually just have the experience?
Yeah, but a couple We had a couple of members here of the Planetary Society. We had a couple of people who got a couple of great shots. I mean, they're this is what they do. They're astronauts.
Oh, and we lost him too. Oh my goodness. There's some kind of glitch in the system today, clearly. Eclipse witching hour. Chad, have we reestablished you in the
interim?
Quick, you can carry on the conversation. We could hear you, but it was like you were talking to me from another planet, actually. You were a long way away.
Maybe yes. I was on the other side of the moon.
Exactly.
I don't know. And I hear myself, too, so I know that you could hear me. So anyway, it just wasn't loud enough. I guess I'll speak louder. Cloud cover did go away during the eclipse, especially for some people in parts of Texas, and that's the good news. I know it looks like it went away and came back, but that is actually the darkening of the cloud cover itself. Because, well, you know what? The satellite wants to see the land. It wants to see the top of the cloud. And this visible satellite was not able to see the clouds when it got dark. So that's just kind of how it goes. Temperatures did go down in the afternoon about 9 degrees Fahrenheit as that cloud kind of came through. And then the moon kind of moved on over. So temperatures really did go down. And then when the moon did go over, the clouds went away and the pictures were spectacular. But temperature drop, relative humidity came up, winds decreased, and the cloud cover, of course, decreased on the satellite underneath. And here's the 9 degree temperature drop in Carbondale, Illinois, also Caribou, Maine, both dropping 9 degrees as, well, you don't have any sunshine, you don't have any insulation, like the incoming solar radiation, then all of a sudden you don't warm up. But then after that, it all did warm back up at least a few degrees, but certainly a colder day because of that lack of sunshine for those few hours.
Julia. Chad Myers, we got there in the end. So thank you so much for that. And the really good news is I think Bill's back with us as well. The CEO of the Plunge. Yay, we've reestablished connection back with you. You were talking about the fact that we did get some great shots, some photographic shots as well. You know, one of the things that I think people need to understand is how unique an experience this is for us Earth dwellers. Due to the interplay, the distances between the moon and the sun. And one of the other things that occurred to me today is what sort of ancient peoples must have thought when these things took place. I mean, we understand the science today. They clearly didn't.
Well, we don't know if they clearly didn't, but it seems like they might be very troubled by it. Apparently, Christopher Columbus took advantage of this. And there's a mythic figure in Mark Twain's story about the Yankee in the court. Yes. And he uses the eclipse to get credence to, I guess, keep from getting in serious trouble. But all that aside, it was a spectacular day. And just to Chad Myers's point, today here in Texas, which is somewhat farther south than New York, Illinois, Cleveland, Montreal, it cooled off more than 9 Fahrenheit. It was almost twice that here. So it was, we had some hardcore people keeping track of it, but it was spectacular. And then when the sun came back, that is to say, when the moon kept going, then you saw this march of sunlight coming toward us. I was never seen that before. It was really, unforgettable.
Breathtaking. And you've seen some of these in the past as well. So when you tell us it's sort of awe-inspiring and spectacular, you certainly know what you're talking about. And you are quite right to correct me, actually. We don't know about our ancestors and what they knew or they didn't. And one of the things, though, that this does represent to me is some ability to predict to the second where we think this is going to hit and the path is the sort of beauty of science and what we have learned over time about our planet. It also ties to what we know. Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, Carl Sagan, this famous astronomer, used to say that a psychic, a tarot card reader, certain people with claiming religious authority, would give their eye teeth, that was his expression, for making predictions akin to this. The hundredth of a second, astronomers can tell when it's going to be dark. And that's just something we all take for granted now, but even a century ago was somewhat difficult. It's just an amazing thing that we understand the syzygy, the alignment of the sun, moon, and earth with such extraordinary precision, predictability, and so on. So it's inspiring. You know, science is the reason we're able to have this electronic conversation right now. And understanding the motion of the celestial objects, the Earth among them, is part of that greater scientific understanding.
Yeah. And also, I think, greater scientific understanding of perhaps the damage that we're doing to our incredibly beautiful planet, too. And what gives me joy about days like today is that we can all come together and celebrate. The hope is perhaps we can come together and solve some of these challenges, too.
It was inspirational. Here in the U.S., Canada, Mexico, we had well over 40 million people who were able to experience it. It was... Let's get together, people, with the passion, beauty, and joy, the PB&J of science.
You said it, my friend. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate your...
Carry on.
...your insights. I shall. Phil Nye there. Thank you so much. All right, straight ahead. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu set a date for the invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza. We're live in Jerusalem. And later in the program, the U.S. Treasury Secretary wraps up her trip to China. But did she succeed in soothing tensions? We'll have the latest from Beijing.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says a date has been set for the invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza. Just take a listen to the statement he posted to Telegram a few hours ago.
Today, I received a detailed report on the talks in Cairo. We are constantly working to achieve our goals, primarily the release of all our hostages and achieving a complete victory over Hamas. This victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
And this announcement coming just as Palestinians begin slowly to return to Khan Yunis after Israeli forces begin to withdraw. Meanwhile, Egyptian state media reports, quote, significant progress in hostage and ceasefire talks in Cairo. It's also been now more than 6 months since Israeli hostages have been held captive in Gaza. Nick Robertson has this report on the latest from Jerusalem.
Khan Yunis's highway of hell, shattered witness to 4 deadly months of Israeli occupation. Nothing untouched. The Jaffa Mosque reduced to rubble. The Acha gas station destroyed. Spreading out from the thoroughfare, a city-sized stamp of destruction. Almost every building in the southern Gazan hub, once home to 420,000 Palestinians, wrecked by Israeli troops searching for Hamas. The scale, testimony of the ferocity of the fight, the graffiti left behind. Venom, Gaza for the Jews, it reads. The IDF's sudden departure over the weekend, opening the way for residents to return to what's left of their homes. It is a shock what happened. It was not small. While coming here in the car, I saw things. The destruction is unbearable. Mohammed Abu Diab tells the cameraman, I'm going to my house and I know it's destroyed. I'm going to remove the rubble and get a shirt out. Return is not victory here. It's resilience. Salim going back to his destroyed home. I will put a tent on it. Even if they destroy all of Khan Yunis, we will stay here and we are steadfast. At first, just a trickle of people coming back, many wary, the withdrawal not what it seems, and with good reason. A drive along the border fence where the troop pulled out, showing just that.
We've just seen two huge explosions over there coming from Khan Yunis area. Looking along the horizon, I can see other detonations and hear the fighter jets pulling off into the distance. It's clear this is still a very active battlefront.
A mile away, scores of recently withdrawn tanks and fighting vehicles parked up. The IDF saying the surprise move marks an end of ground operations in Gaza in their current form. Warning, though, troops out to recuperate and prepare for future operations.
The war in Gaza continues and we are far from stopping.
Whatever next for the people of Khan Yunis, these days are a respite. Impossible to say if the IDF withdrawal, an inflection point towards a ceasefire and an end to the destruction and killing.
Our thanks to Nick Robertson there. We'll be back after this. Plenty more First Move to come. Welcome back to First Move with a look at more of the international headlines this hour. A New York appeals court has denied a bid from former President Donald Trump asking to delay the start of his hush money trial. Trump's legal team had wanted the court to hear a request to change the trial venue. The trial is set to begin next week with jury selection. Ukraine denies Russian accusations that it launched a drone attack Sunday at the Zaporizhzhia power plant. The nuclear plant has been under Russian control since the early days of the war. The UN's energy watchdog said damage from Sunday's attack did not compromise nuclear safety, but warned that fighting there increases the risk of a major nuclear accident. Mexico plans to report Ecuador to the International Court of Justice for raiding its embassy in Quito. Countries throughout Latin America have condemned the raid, calling it a major diplomatic breach. Ecuadorian special forces stormed the embassy Friday to arrest the country's former vice president, who's been seeking asylum. Mexico's diplomatic staff left Ecuador on Sunday. Now, civilians in Gaza have now endured 6 months of blockade and bombing. And for the families of those still held captive by Hamas, it's been 6 months of anguish and pain as they wait to be reunited with their loved ones. Yifat Zeila tried to describe what it's been like for her.
There's no words that can explain what this 6 months has been like for me and for my family. It's a torture, it's a nightmare still. I can't believe that we're speaking again after 6 months and nothing has changed. We know nothing, we have no news, no sign of life, nothing.
Now, Nada Bashir has more on the scale of destruction and human tragedy in Gaza. And a warning, some of the images in this report are disturbing.
Celebrating a graduation full of hope for the future. This was life in Gaza for Ihab's family before the war. Now, Ihab is one of almost 2 million Palestinians that have been displaced. We never needed anything from anyone before the war, Ihab says. But now we are in a situation where I am forced to beg for a loaf of bread just to feed the children. In this makeshift shelter, without access to adequate food supplies or medical care, Ihab's husband became severely malnourished and later died. The hardest thing was losing my husband, the way in which he died, she says. We're all going to die one day, but every death has a reason. He died from hunger, from oppression. He had no food and no water for 55 days. It's very difficult for me to accept this. Satellite images show the scale of the destruction in central Gaza. Buildings, roads, completely destroyed by Israel's relentless bombing campaign. Israel says it is targeting Hamas, but 6 months on, and the death toll has now surpassed 33,000. The vast majority, civilians. Each week has brought with it yet more horror. More bodies pulled from beneath the rubble of destroyed homes, more funerals. Survivors forced to flee from one battleground to another. And now, more children left emaciated by a hunger crisis which is threatening to push Gaza deeper towards famine. UN experts have accused Israel of intentionally starving the Palestinian people by restricting access to aid, with dire shortages leading to deadly desperation. What few hospitals remain in Gaza are overrun and desperately lacking in essential supplies. Gaza's largest medical facility, Al-Shifa, now turned into a graveyard by Israel's bloody 14-day siege on the complex. In just 6 months, this war has become the deadliest conflict for children, aid workers, and journalists. Fuad Al-Mani has worked through multiple wars in Gaza, but he says he has never seen anything like this before. His son, a fellow paramedic, was killed by an Israeli airstrike while responding to an emergency call. Others have lost tens of family members, Fuad says, but losing my son feels like I've lost the entire world. Desperate to escape Israel's near constant air assault on Gaza, more than a million people have sought refuge in the southern border city of Rafah, where Israel says it is preparing for a ground incursion, a move the UN warns would lead to unimaginable disaster. Israel's actions in Gaza have triggered a genocide hearing at the International Court of Justice, allegations Israel denies, and a UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. But hopes for peace remain elusive. The beach makes me forget our pain, our sadness, our martyrs, Ihab says. Every time I come, I complain to the sea, hoping that God will respond and finally take us away from this pain. Nedha Bashir, CNN, London.
More First Move after this.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has just arrived in the United States for the first U.S. state visit by a Japanese leader in almost a decade. Kishida's plane landing around an hour ago at Joint Base Andrews just outside Washington, D.C. During his trip, Kishida will hold meetings with President Biden as well as the President of the Philippines, focusing on Asian security. He's also set to address a joint session of Congress. Kishida hoping for a better reception in the United States, perhaps, and he's getting back at home where he suffers from low approval ratings due in part to a political scandal. Hanako Montgomery joins us now. Hanako, the first time in almost a decade that we've had a Japanese leader here in the United States. It's being portrayed certainly as a fresh high in relations, whether it's greater coordination over AI, technology, climate change, but I think it is the defense ties that are really going to be pored over.
Absolutely, Julia. As you rightly pointed out, I think at this upcoming state visit, we can expect Kishida and Biden to discuss how they'll be upgrading and strengthening their bilateral ties. And according to some of the experts I spoke to, they said that it really seems as though the two leaders are trying to cement as many agreements as possible before they could see a potential leadership change. As you rightly pointed out, Kishida is dealing with very low approval ratings in his home country. And in the United States, we know that we have a U.S. presidential election coming up in November. Now, during our conversation with the Japanese Prime Minister on Sunday, he warned that the world was at a historic turning point. He pointed to the Israel-Hamas war, Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine, and of course, issues much closer to home. Despite international sanctions, North Korea is ramping up its nuclear weapons program, and China is increasing its aggression in the South China Sea. Even more reason, according to Kishida, to strengthen U.S. and Japanese alliances. Here's what he told us on Sunday.
The world at a historic turning point, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida tells me, ahead of a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden this week. The longtime partners will upgrade their defense relationship to the next level in the backdrop of mounting international security challenges.
In our neighborhood, there are countries that are developing ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, and others that are building up their defense capabilities in an opaque way. Also, there is a unilateral attempt to change the status quo by force in both the East China Sea and South China Sea.
Kishida says soaring geopolitical tensions force Japan, long a pacifist country, to change its defense posture, moves not seen since World War II. Under his leadership, Japan plans to boost its defense spending to 2% of its GDP by 2027 and purchase weapons, including U.S.-made Tomahawk cruise missiles, acquiring counter-strike capabilities for the first time in decades.
So if Japan has a security pact with the United States, why does it need counter-strike capabilities?
Missile-related technology is evolving year by year. As missiles become more sophisticated, Japan must constantly consider what kind of technology is needed to protect the lives and livelihood of its citizens.
And you've asked for a summit with Kim Jong-un, but there seems to be some mixed messages coming from North Korea about its engagement with Japan. What is your current level of communication between your administration and North Korea?
We believe that resolving various concerns between Japan and North Korea and stabilizing relations is important, not only for the interests of our two countries, but also for peace and stability in the region. For this reason, we believe that it is important to hold a summit meeting, and under my supervision, I've been conducting high-level outreach to the DPRK.
Following the U.S.-Japan summit, the two nations will convene with the Philippines, the first trilateral meeting of its kind, to address rising security threats from North Korea weapons testing and aggression in the South China Sea.
We are not targeting China specifically or a specific country. As Japan, we've been working to strengthen the Philippines' maritime enforcement capabilities. We're also providing them with defense-related equipment.
You mentioned that it's not directed towards any one country, but wouldn't you say that the Philippines is gravely concerned about China's actions in the South China Sea?
It's true that there are some developments, as you pointed out. I think it's important for the Philippines to defend its sovereignty, to protect its own territory, territorial waters, and airspace. I believe that these things are very important in maintaining and strengthening a free and open Indo-Pacific based on the rule of law.
The U.S. and Japan, an enduring bond, confronts its pivotal moment as a volatile world seeks to unravel their global sway.
So, Julia, clearly counter-strike capabilities are very important to Japan because it feels as though it needs to protect itself with its own powers. But also, the bilateral ties between Japan and the United States is key for Japan. And under Kishida's leadership, we've seen the U.S., Japan, and South Korea decide to share real-time information about North Korea's nuclear weapons and missile programs. So I think at this upcoming state visit, we can expect to see much, much more of that, much more defense cooperation between those two countries. Julia.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see. We'll watch more of it, obviously, later on your time and tomorrow for us here in the United States. Hanneke Montgomery, great interview. Thank you so much for that. Now, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has wrapped up her four-day trip to China, where she aimed to ease tensions between the world's two largest economies. However, Yellen also didn't shy away from challenging China on their vast manufacturing capacity and exports that are putting pressure on global prices for items such as solar panels and electric cars. Mark Stewart joins us now from Beijing. And Mark, I believe you got the only question actually to Janet Yellen in that press conference, and you didn't shy from asking her some of the challenging questions that I think a lot of us are asking: national security risks, opportunities for US and foreign businesses in China. Talk us through your interaction.
Right, Julia, the only broadcaster. Look, it is just after 6:30 in the morning, and Secretary Yellen is wrapping up her trip at a time when there has been a lot of skepticism and suspicion from Wall Street, from Main Street, from Washington toward this relationship between the United States and China, particularly how it relates to government involvement in the business sector. I mean, we've had these issues lately with TikTok, with EVs. And I talked to her about this during this Q&A at the U.S. ambassador's home here in Beijing. Let's take a brief listen. Is this skepticism warranted? And how will you know if a threshold has been reached, a new level of comfort for American firms to feel encouraged to do business here in China?
I've tried in our conversations to make clear that this is a reason for caution on the part of American firms about doing business here. I think on each side we need to be as transparent as we can about our national security concerns and how the actions we take relate to resolving those concerns.
And these national security concerns, it's a very broad category. I mean, obviously it's about data collection issues, but it also relates to the war in Ukraine. The United States has been very critical, very concerned that China is serving as this economic lifeline to China and that Chinese firms are helping Russia in its war efforts. And so that is something that the secretary condemned, if that is the case, saying that she had many difficult conversations on that in particular, Julia.
So many facets, aren't there, to this relationship in particular? And it follows what 2 weeks ago, a whole bunch of some of the biggest US CEOs actually in China having these discussions. They'll continue to operate there. The question is, what gives them the confidence, to your question to her, about investing more, perhaps? How was the whole trip perceived and how has it been perceived? Because last week we were talking about social media complimenting Janet Yellen on her chopstick skills and her choices of how mm-hmm. and what kind of cuisine that she was eating while there. Mark, how has the whole trip been portrayed in terms of sort of broader relations between U.S. and China?
Look, there's no question that Janet Yellen has struck a chord with the Chinese public, in part because she's kind of novel in this part of the world, in the sense that she is a woman on the front lines, but also is very down to earth. I mean, you mentioned the fascination with her chopstick skills. You know, when she was at this restaurant, she didn't sit in a private seating area. She was in a big public area. And for Chinese officials, government officials, I mean, that's something unheard of, to be viewed dining in public. You know, a lot of times when Chinese government officials travel, they have a big entourage. There's someone carrying the umbrella next to an official so they don't get wet. I mean, Janet Yellen has been doing everything on her own. There's also been remarks about the fact that she carried her bag off the plane on her own. I mean, there is this down-to-earthness that is striking a chord with the Chinese public. But with all that said, this visit is not necessarily, you know, a free pass for her. I mean, while the press and while social media has been, you know, very praiseworthy of her daily, you know, interactions here in China, there's also some very strong headlines. I mean, I was just looking at one government paper saying that the U.S. should not politicize trade issues, Premier Li tells Yellen. So there is this balance, but there's something about her that is endearing, no question, to people here in China, Julia.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean she went with a soft message. It was certainly a tough one. And there's plenty of people now that think perhaps tariffs on some of these EVs and solar panels and some of the green energy products will follow. Watch this space. Mark, thank you.
Not off the table.
Not off the table. Yes. Chopsticks or otherwise. Thank you. All right, let's look at today's money move. And we may have had an eclipse totality, but no Wall Street vitality. U.S. stocks beginning the new week little changed as investors await the start of first quarter earnings season and important U.S. inflation numbers too. We also had higher bond yields weighing on sentiment as well. And then comes JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon
warning in his annual shareholder letter that U.S. government borrowing could contribute to persistent inflation. He said his bank is preparing a worst-case scenario for rates spiking to 8%. He's given that warning before, and it was met with plenty of raised eyebrows. Now, in Asia, Japanese stocks rising almost 1%, eclipsing the performance for the rest of the region, as you can see. And in other business news, call it a case of semiconductor superlatives. Taiwan Semiconductor announcing on Monday that it will build its most advanced chips in the United States as part of a new multi-billion dollar deal with the Biden administration. The money coming from the U.S. CHIPS Act. Taiwan Semi now plans to operate three production facilities in the state of Arizona, assuring the United States it has steady access to its cutting-edge chips. Claire Duffy has more.
Just to put into context why this is so important, these advanced chips go into everything from our iPhones to our computers, our cars, home appliances, so many of the devices that we rely on every day, and yet the majority of them are produced outside of the United States. That means that the U.S. has very little control if something were to disrupt the supply chain for these advanced chips. This is something that the Biden administration has been really focused on for the past couple of years, trying to grow the U.S. domestic supply chain for these chips. And this $6.6 billion investment in TSMC will go a long way towards getting there. TSMC has already been in the process of building two new fabrication facilities in Arizona. Now it says it will be building a third, bringing its total investment in the U.S. to $65 billion. One question, though, that I have, Julia, as I've been talking to experts about this issue, is how TSMC is going to find the workers for these facilities. The company says that these three new fabrication plants will create around 6,000 high-paying tech jobs, but these semiconductor manufacturing roles are highly specialized. And the experts that I've talked to say that the U.S. needs to be doing more to invest in training the workers for these positions beyond just investing in the facilities themselves. Claire Duffy, CNN, New York.
Okay, coming up on First Move, a huge night for men's college basketball in the United States as the University of Connecticut trying to make a bit of history. Plus, Caitlin Clark's last game as a college superstar. Next. And welcome back to First Move. And the biggest night of the year for men's college basketball in the United States is tonight. The tournament known as March Madness is down to its final game. In just a few hours, Purdue will take on the University of Connecticut, last year's champions. Meanwhile, South Carolina won the women's title on Sunday, defeating Caitlin Clark's Iowa. I can barely bring myself to say it. Her brilliant college career ending without a national championship, but she's still expected to be the number one pick in next week's women's pro basketball draft.
When I think about women's basketball going forward, you know, obviously, it's just going to continue to grow, whether it's at the WNBA level, whether it's at the college level. Like, everybody sees it. Everybody knows. Everybody sees the viewership numbers. When you're given an opportunity, women's sports just kind of thrives. And I think that's been the coolest part for me on this journey.
And Coy Wire joins us now. Coy, she may not have won on the night, but she's a total winner, quite frankly. And she was magnanimous in defeat as well. And a record number of people watched her achieve something huge.
Yes, the women broke viewership records incrementally in each of the final three rounds of the tournament, Julia, and South Carolina's championship win over Iowa averaged 18.7 million viewers. It peaked at 24 million, making it the most watched basketball game in the last 5 years, college, NBA, WNBA, all of them. And it's the most watched sporting event outside of football and the Olympics in the last half decade as well. So this groundswell of support for women's sports continues to grow. Congratulations to Dawn Staley and her South Carolina Gamecocks being crowned champions of 2024. Now tonight, the focus shifts to UConn and Purdue here in Arizona for the men's national title game. Only two other teams in the last 50 years have been able to repeat as champions, and UConn has a chance to be the next. They'd be the first since Florida did it in 2007 if they can pull it off. They're on a tournament record streak of 11 straight double-digit wins. Now Purdue has never won a title, but this title run may be written in the stars. Playing in the championship on the day their home state of Indiana sits in the path of totality of the solar eclipse. The only other time they played for a title was 1969, the year that Purdue alum Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And the last time a total solar eclipse was visible in Indiana was 1869. That was the year that Purdue University was founded. You can't make this stuff up, Julia. I caught up with Coach Matt Painter, who says he wants nothing more than to bring a championship home for the fans.
It'd be great for our fans. It'd be great for our players, our former players, you know, Coach Katie, Bruce Weber, you know, all the people that have helped me be in this position. And they deserve it. You know, you see a lot of people, you know, on the back nine of their lives. And like, it's a big thing that they've stayed with us and supported us, and they want to be able to see it.
Now, Julia, two gigantic men taller than Shaquille O'Neal are facing off tonight. Purdue's 7'4" Zach Edey, UConn's 7'2" Donovan Clingan. It's the first matchup of 7-footers in a final since Patrick Ewing and Hakeem Olajuwon more than 40 years ago. So we will see who can get it done. Will it be Purdue and their two-time reigning National Player of the Year, Edey, or will UConn get those back-to-back wins? We'll soon see. Julia, thank you.
Wow. Gold star to you as well for the eclipse sport history lesson there. That was astonishing. Almost as good as watching the eclipse. Kai Wire, thank you so much for that. And finally, on First Move, an unusual and exciting spectacle at the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta. And it didn't involve a ball or a club during Monday's practice round. The sky got a slightly darker hue during the solar eclipse. And lucky fans were given a very special souvenir, Masters branded solar eclipse glasses. Wow, they've got to be worth something. Also, people in Mazatlan, Mexico, were the first to witness the eclipse in its totality. It then traveled over Texas, where the sky turned dark over the Dallas Zoo. The Midwestern United States came next. What a day. And that just about wraps up the show. Thank you for joining us. I'll see you tomorrow.